The next few weeks are critical for sowing wheat and other crops in Ukraine, which is currently involved in a conflict. Dr. John Rich, the chair of the MHP, one of the country's biggest grain producers, says, "If this continues, of course, our ability to sow rapidly diminishes, particularly if the conflict in Ukraine is prolonged." He said this could lead to complete failure of Ukraine to produce any grain. "The consequences are unimaginable as far as Ukraine is concerned," he said. "For the wider world, it's simple. The price of wheat will continue to rise. The price of corn and other commodities will also rise significantly. And you have spiraling inflation at a time when we already had problems with the global supply chain because of the COVID pandemic," he added.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Early January, Ghanaians were pleasantly surprised to see the country's Speaker of Parliament, Alban Begbin, dressed in traditional clothing instead of a ceremonial outfit with colonial links. He addressed Parliament on the reason for adapting Ghana's traditional attire.
"We must create a unique set of values and norms that will give a unique character to our parliament, to set it apart from the colonial legacies of the British system."
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. Today, we are focusing on a very commendable decision by the Speaker of Ghana's Parliament to dump decades-old cloak of the Speaker for traditional Ghanaian attire. This move is seen as a step towards the revival of the country's rich culture. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the decision by Twitter to disable accounts of African activists opposed to United States imperialism. We are asking, why are the US-based social media giants intent on muzzling the voices of freedom in Africa? Stay with us as our experts give us their insight.
Ghana, back to the roots. The Speaker of the Parliament in Ghana, Alban Babin, fulfilled his promise of limiting the wearing of Western suits and gowns during sitting in the House. The Speaker ditched his ceremonial outfit for traditional attire for sitting in the House on January 25, 2022. He wore a traditional outfit with kente cloth and a crown worn by chiefs during ceremonies. The kente fabric comes originally from Ghana centuries ago and is one of the best known of all African textiles. The kente cloth subsequently became a symbol of Pan-African identity and a symbol of black pride.
Now, prior to wearing kente during his official parliamentary duties, Begbin urged members of parliament to promote locally made traditional outfits and market Ghanaian culture instead of wearing Western attire.
"You will not be seeing me often again with that dress code, a suit, and that aristocratic cloak or gown. You may be seeing me more with traditional dresses. I may use that only for ceremonial occasions, which is what is in the literature of Ghana concerning that cloak and gown. It's for only ceremonial occasions. So those who know former speakers, you see former speaker Asedu wearing a kente and a shirt. And that is what is the portrait we have today. And so we have to change all that. Well, we have to provide the market for our produce."
Now, for more on the move by Ghana's parliament speaker to adopt the country's traditional clothing, we contacted Jonathan Ofei Ansua, Ghanaian journalist and commentator. He's also the publisher of Africa Briefing. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, what's your initial reaction to the move by Ghana's parliament speaker to dump decades-old colonial cloak for the country's traditional clothing?
Well, I do applaud him, you know, for the step he's taking, because we are Ghanaians, and we have our traditions, we have our customs, we have our costumes. We've been independent for 65 years. So I see no reason why, you know, the parliamentary speaker should be donned in the colonial regalia with the wig. Look, even considering the weather, though the parliament is fully air-conditioned, still, it does not speak well, you know, of our culture, for our culture. You know, we have cultures, we have our own costumes. So I believe that the step he's taken, you know, should be applauded.
Ghanaians were clearly delighted by their parliament speaker for adopting the country's traditional attire. Many Ghanaians say the speaker showed the way in promoting the Ghana brand, and he urged the Chief Justice to emulate the speaker in ensuring that lawyers and judges are also permitted to dress in local fabrics in court. Can we say there is some sort of revival in the country and people are tired of colonial relics and want to return to their roots?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, judging by the reaction, you know, from Ghanaians, you know, generally within the country, I think, look, it shows how proud Ghanaians are of their heritage. Though I must say that We've been influenced a lot by Western cultural influences. But look, these days, when I was growing up, you know, in my teens, whatever, we all used to listen to soul music, reggae, you know, so on and so forth. But these days, when I go to Ghana, everywhere you go, especially the youth, you know, they all listen to Ghanaian music. Everywhere you go, it's Ghanaian music, Ghanaian music. So that should tell you that Ghanaians, you know, are at least the current youth, you know, the youth of today, the Ghanaian youth of today, appreciate more, you know, their culture than any Western influences.
The Ghanaian government has introduced the use of locally made Ankara fabrics as school uniforms in order to promote African prints.
The Speaker of Ghana's Parliament says his decision to adopt the Kente traditional attire goes in line with the aspirations of the first President of Ghana, Kwame Nkrumah.
That this decision accords with some of the propositions of the first President of Ghana, Dr. Kwame Nkrumah, and the other founding members of the Parliament of the First Republic. The government dress code of members of the National Assembly of Independent Ghana was native costume.
Now, what impact will the move to adopt African fabrics have on the youth in Ghana?
It's going to have a very, very positive impact. I recall about 20 or so years ago, the government did not rule, but set this trend on that every Friday, public servants should not go to work in Western attire. So these days, you go to Ghana, you go to the ministries, offices, whatever, you see men and women wearing traditional garments. The men usually wear shirts made from Ghanaian cotton prints.
The government of Ghana is also involved in efforts to promote local products and boost employment. The Made in Ghana initiative was developed by the Ministry of Trade and Industry to promote products made in this West African country. In his introductory remarks after deciding to wear the traditional attire, this is what Ghana's president said on the need to promote products made in the country.
This is the Parliament of Ghana. It's a unique Made in Ghana product. And we must showcase and market it to the world as a brand.
Can the move to traditional attire be replicated in other sectors to attain self-sufficiency and disentangle the country from dependency and neo-colonialism?
It's a mindset that not only Ghanaians, Africans in general, have this mindset that anything coming from abroad is better than what, you know, is being produced locally. Like, you take a vehicle, you take a computer, you take a mobile phone, I mean, name it. Even close, I mean, they think, Africans think that whatever is manufactured abroad in Europe, America, China, Asia, is much better than what is produced locally. So it's a trend that's a mindset, but it will take a long time for this mindset to change. So what the government is doing now is a step in the right direction, but it's they are taking the baby steps. Okay, I mean, the school children wearing uniforms made from our own local fabrics, and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth. So by the time they grow to be adults, that culture will be ingrained, will be inculcated in them to move forward. So I believe that, look, it's a mindset. A mindset, it takes a long to change one's mindset. But I believe that Ghana and Africa will get there.
In Africa, dress provides a powerful tool to challenge neo-colonialism and is also considered an effective method of cultural expression and resistance. Now, additionally, a person's dress code can reveal dimensions of political and social transformations that cannot be discerned through verbal and written articulations. There is a movement now to drop colonial attire in African parliaments and judicial organs. Now, most countries in Africa still use clothing linked to cultural colonialism. Isn't it about time that African countries take serious measures to revive their cultural identity?
Well, you take Moscow, look, go to Nigeria and go to the Sahelian countries, you know, Niger, Burkina Faso, Mali, Guinea, Senegal, Gambia. Most of them wear the bubu, you know, the African bubu, you know. And you take the armed services, like let's say the police, the army, they wear uniforms, okay? I mean, it is convenient. I mean, a policeman cannot wear the traditional African garment. In Ghana, our very traditional, the men wear a cloth wrapped over the shoulder. A policeman cannot use that garment. Neither can a soldier. So that the uniform used by the security services, the army, the police, and so on and so forth, I think it's okay. But look, it will take a long time. We need to start from somewhere. Recently, the African Union officially adopted Swahili, the Swahili language, as an official working language for the EU. That is one step. So look, if you learn, you know your language, the more you know your language, the more you know your culture. So it will take some time, but I believe that eventually Africa will get there.
Thank you very much, Ofei and Sa, for your time and insight. Indeed, Africa is on the right path towards cultural revival. Now, we now take a short break, and our next subject will be on the crackdown launched by Twitter against African activists opposed to imperialism and neocolonialism. So stay with us.
Twitter crackdown on African activists.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
United States social media giant Twitter has disabled the accounts of several Ethiopians and Eritreans and their related groups without justification. Now, the accounts had recently helped promote the No More and Hands Off hashtags in the campaign against illegal intervention by the U.S. in the internal affairs of the two countries and other parts of Africa.
Amongst the disabled accounts was Horn of Africa Hub, a page started in October 2021 with over 18.8 thousand followers. This page described itself as combating false, deadly narratives about the Horn of Africa, including in Ethiopia, Somalia, Eritrea, Djibouti, and beyond.
Now, apart from the activities on Twitter, activists have also organized peaceful protests across the world to popularize the No More and Hands Off hashtags. There is one such protest in South Africa.
These things happened the past 3 years, you know. We've been trying to solve out the things in back home, but still he trying. Our Prime Minister, Dr. Abiy, he trying himself. But the thing is, the other opponent party, the TPLF, they don't want the leadership that he's running. And then they get support from U.S., actually. They get truly support from U.S. because the overseas news, the parties which is passing through CNN, BBC, the fake news that they produce for us.
Now, for more on the Twitter crackdown on online movements opposed to U.S. imperialism and neocolonialism, we contacted Hermela Ergawi, an Ethiopian-American journalist. Thanks a lot for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, we have seen lies on mainstream media and crackdowns on the social media. What's your take on the crackdown by the social media giants against online activists?
Well, first, I think it's important to note that I was for a long time a part of the mainstream media. I've worked for the CBS affiliate in LA, Al Jazeera America, which is pretty mainstream when it was launched here, as well as other local affiliates. So I'm very familiar with what the standards of mainstream media are supposed to be. And so I was really disappointed to find out that a lot of the reporting in the usual mainstream outlets like CNN, New York Times, was over time became very clear that it was not objective, that it was telling only this one-sided story, very much became propaganda. And so that's what inspired me to sort of move into this space and be a part of the conversation. And social media is the only way to really push back when you are reaching out to CNN and reaching out to outlets and saying, hey, this part of the story you guys are not covering over the course of months, then the only outlet you really have is social media. So we started the hashtag No More campaign to push back against a lot of the false narratives that were taking hold in the mainstream outlets.
Hashtag No More Movement started in Ethiopia and the Horn of Africa and then quickly spread out to other regions in Africa and beyond around the world and became a symbol of resistance against imperialism. In as far as Norway, Ethiopians and other diaspora Africans gathered to express their opposition to the U.S. meddling in Africa.
TPLF is a terrorist organization. TPLF is a Trojan horse of United States. USA, learn from your mistakes. No to US invasion. No to US invasion in Ethiopia. No to US invasion in Eritrea. We stand for peace.
We stand for peace
in Ethiopia.
In Ethiopia.
We stand for peace.
We stand for peace
with Eritrea. Hands off Ethiopia.
Ms. Aregari, can you elaborate more on what the No More and Hands Off hashtags are all about?
So hashtag No More was created in response to what was essentially government propaganda, U.S. government propaganda that was being told through mainstream media outlets about the conflict in Ethiopia. The mainstream narrative was that the Ethiopian government was trying to genocide the people of Tigray. Tigray is a region with ethnic Tigrayans, or largely ethnic Tigrayans, which make up maybe about 5% of the population. Both of my parents are from there, so I guess you would say I'm ethnically Tigrayan. So there is no part of me that wants to support a genocide against people of my ethnicity, and there isn't evidence to back that.
Twitter has taken down thousands of accounts in vast sweeps that sometimes claim to be targeting state-directed disinformation operations, but actually the objective is to clamp down on anti-US messages. Why are Western powers, especially the US, muzzling free African voices, especially Ethiopians, in social media platforms who are opposed to the TPLF rebels?
I really think the foreign policy right now is so extremely misguided. I don't think that this helps the U.S. at all. Honestly, the communities in the diaspora are trying to understand, why is the U.S. betting on this group that they cannot rely on? This group cannot even be relied on by their own people in the Tigray region, who are essentially at this point held hostage, right? So it's really confusing, because it doesn't seem productive, but the U.S. has taken the stance anyway.
The anti-war no more was a trending hashtag for weeks until Twitter blocked it. Now, despite the censorship by Twitter, this African campaign continues on social media platforms. Activists say that apart from Ethiopia, this campaign is also targeting U.S. interference in other African countries.
Ethiopians can govern their own affair. The United States should not be interfering in this, and that is why we are here. We say we are here to say no more Afghanistan, no more Syria in Ethiopia. Ethiopia can decide its own fate. And the interference that we see from Western countries is totally uncalled for. It's not necessary, and it should stop.
Over 100 million people are supporting the current government, and here in diaspora have a high support of what's going on in Ethiopia. So we're trying to tell the Biden administration, don't interfere. Ethiopia is a sovereign nation. We can make decisions and should not be supporting the terrorist group who wants to come back to power again by force.
Now, Ms. Aregawi, do you think the U.S. and other Western powers will succeed in silencing the voices of Africans who say no more to imperialism and neocolonialism?
I do not think they will be successful in silencing the people that are rallying around no more. This is something that's been decades in the making. The frustration that people have didn't just pop up last year. This is something really deep that the people know really well. And so it's a matter of how the U.S. will respond. So will they evolve? Will foreign policy here in the U.S. evolve in how it's been dealing with the Horn of Africa and other parts of Africa? Or is it just going to stay down this road, destroy the relationships with those countries, and essentially push them in a different direction in terms of geopolitics and who they choose to ally with? And you do see that. There's some support from Russia and China in the Horn of Africa. And part of that is the U.S. has just essentially pushed the people of that country in that direction, because they continue to tell the propaganda of the armed terrorist group that has waged a war on the people of Ethiopia. So all these different groups can't be silent.
Twitter is now facing accusations of pursuing a destabilization policy in Africa. The Nigerian says the U.S. technology company is employing double standards and supporting the secessionists in the West African country.
U.S. social media giants have come under fire over misuse of their platforms to spread hate and incitement in conflict areas in Africa and elsewhere. Now, what's your take on that?
You know, like everything else, if you don't evolve, you die. So there are more than 1.3 billion people in Africa. Many of them are young. Over the course of the next decade or two, many of them are going to be using social media platforms. So if Twitter and Facebook does not become more culturally competent and hire people from the diaspora in different regions to get a a better understanding of what is going on in those countries, then they will either intentionally or unintentionally be backing groups that are essentially behind violent elements in different countries. So in the beginning, I thought it was a context issue, even with the mainstream media. And then over time, when they had data that was countering what they were alleging and chose to ignore it, then it became clear that this was intentional.
Thank you very much, Ms. Haramela Aregawi, for your incisive analysis. Unfortunately, our time is up for today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, we shall keep our eyes on the anti-imperialist movement in Africa here at Africa Today. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Send us your comments through our social media handle and let us know your opinion. It was great having you, and goodbye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
The most recent example of the fulfillment of these needs is the people's presence in the 22nd of Bahman rally a few days ago. Today's 22nd of Bahman was astonishing. It was really a spontaneous move. It was really a spontaneous movement that people did, and it was really admirable. This move was truly praiseworthy. With the problems that surround the people, the coronavirus and the livelihood problems. On the one hand, the modest slinging of foreigners and the unfortunate contribution of some internal elements to the same modest slinging. On the other hand, and despite all these obstacles and problems, the people held a great rally. Those who record the population of the participants and who can guess their numbers with cameras and whose estimation is very close to reality, reported to us that in all but two or three provinces of the country, this year the population was larger than last year. In some provinces, the turnout was twice as much as last year. In some provinces, it was 40-50% more. It was like this everywhere. The people's move showed an astonishing vigilance. These are really admirable and meaningful moves. Well, these are examples of the people's recognition of present-day needs and of their voluntary and innovative moves.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
And there are certain issues that form the needs of the future. Many people identify them and carry out the necessary task, and some people show negligence about them. What I mean by future means is the needs that will make us hit rock bottom if we do not think of them and do not do anything for them now. If we do not think of them at present, we will face problems tomorrow. Training scientists and researchers is an example in this regard. If we do not train researchers today, and if we do not launch a great scientific movement, then in 15, 20 years' time, we will no longer have outstanding scientists capable of competing with the world or crossing the frontiers of science.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me.
In the limelight.
The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by David Cronin, writer. This article is titled, EU admits teaming up with Israeli regime police enables mass surveillance. Stay tuned for more. The European Union funds research involving Israeli regime's police, despite admitting that it may be used for spying purposes. Over the past few years, a project named Roxan has been examining how criminals can be identified with the aid of speech recognition technology and visual analysis. Material intended for public consumption presents the EU finance project costing $8 million as benign. However, serious ethical issues have been raised when it was discussed behind closed doors. Internal EU documents obtained under Freedom of Information rules confirm there is a risk that Roxan's results will be used for mass surveillance. An ethics check on the project conducted during 2020
refers to plans that personal data will be shared between the EU and the Zionist regime. The data collected during the project will incorporate special categories such as details on the genetic traits, health, lifestyle, political opinion, religious or philosophical conviction of individuals, according to that paper. The surrounding questions have become even more pertinent since the ethics check was carried out. Painstaking investigations by human rights groups proved last year that the Zionist regime's Pegasus spyware is being used more widely than was previously known to monitor campaigners and journalists in various countries. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry are among the participants in Roxane. A condition of their involvement is that all data they export to the EU should be collected lawfully. Providing assurances of legal behavior is apparently deemed sufficient for the purposes of EU ethics checks to demonstrate that privacy issues are being treated seriously. In the real world, an Israeli assurance is completely worthless. The Zionist regime's police are seeking new powers that would allow greater surveillance without requiring warrants. A key proposal is that cameras in public places could be used to match people's faces with details found on police databases. Such a recommendation should, in itself, disqualify the Zionist regime's police from Roxane, which pays lip service to the principle of privacy awareness. There are, of course, numerous other reasons why the Zionist regime's police should not be benefiting from EU science grants. One major reason is that the Zionist regime's police are institutionally racist. A recent Human Rights Watch report on Lid, a city within the occupied Palestinian territories, also known as Lod, contains a vivid example of police racism. The report describes how police fire tear gas and stun grenades at a protest by Palestinian citizens of occupied territories in Lod last May. Yet, in some cases, when Jewish extremists attacked Palestinians in the same city that month, the police either stood by or failed to protect Palestinians from harm. The Zionist regime's police and public security ministry both have their headquarters in East Al-Quds, which has been under military occupation since 1967. Doing business with them should, by definition, be off-limits for the European Union, which is nominally committed to avoiding action that would lend the capture and colonization of East Al-Quds any legitimacy. There are strong indications that the Zionist regime has not been entirely candid with administrators in Brussels. Documents for Roxane project give an address inside the occupied territories as the official contact for the public security ministry. If Brussels officials consulted the ministry's website, they would learn that its main offices can be actually found on Clermont's Gano Street in East Al-Quds. The involvement of the Zionist regime's police and public security ministry in Roxane and another EU-funded project called Law Train has sparked protest from the Palestine Solidarity Movement. More protest is needed. The Zionist regime's police and its public security ministry have been admitted into at least 8 other projects under Horizon 2020, the EU's current research fund. Among them are 2 border surveillance initiatives, Andromeda and Safe Shore. As border surveillance has become synonymous with cruelty toward refugees, questions must be asked about the precise role being played by the Zionist regime's racist police. A particularly troubling aspect of all this cooperation is that boasts made by the Zionist regime police are seemingly taken at face value. An EU-funded project called Shuttle is building a database of blood, gunshot residues, hair, and saliva. The Zionist regime's police force is taking part and will contribute its experience as a forensic expert and technological leader, according to Shuttle website. There is no acknowledgement that the Zionist regime is actually an expert in operation. By awarding research grants to the Zionist regime police, the EU is rewarding a force that detains Palestinian children, terrifies entire families by invading their homes, and opens fire on worshippers in Al-Quds Al-Aqsa Mosque. The EU's hypocrisy seems boundless. Shortly before Hisham Abu Hawash ended his hunger strike earlier this week, EU diplomats proclaimed themselves seriously concerned about his health. The diplomats were not concerned enough to demand that the EU stop cooperating with the Zionist regime's public security ministry, the regime's department overseeing the prisons where Abu Hawash and many other Palestinians are locked up without charge or trial. In December, an agreement was signed so that the Zionist regime can benefit from the EU's next research fund. Named Horizon Europe, the fund has an overall budget of approximately $110 billion. Predictably, the EU promoted the new agreement by celebrating how its cooperation with the Zionist regime has supposedly brought great advancements in medicine and environmental protection. Just as predictably, there was no mention that the cooperation is a cash cow for the Zionist regime's racist police.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Back on March 11, 2012, a U.S. Army sergeant horrifically killed at least 16 civilians, including 9 children, and wounded 6 others in Panjwayi district of Kandahar province. Today, Afghans recall the killings as shocking and inhuman, saying they can't forget about the U.S. war crimes in their country.
Around 10 years ago, a terrifying shooting was carried out on my relatives in the Zangawad village in Kandahar. It was like a nightmare. I can't forget it. American forces opened fire on civilians, including children and women. We did protests against the U.S. and didn't let them sweep it under the carpet. Americans should be held accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan.
Sayed Ishaq Gelani was a former Afghan MP. He led the Afghan team to investigate the Panjwayi mass killing. He denies an individual act, saying it was planned and more Americans were involved.
Throughout our investigation, we found out that there was more than one shooter. We saw 20 footprints of the American forces at the scenes of crimes. The incident was shocking and tragic. It looked like a group of U.S. soldiers had done that. Then they blamed everything on one of their drunk teammates. The U.S. forces threatened the local people not to tell us the truth.
Sardar Muhammad, the lawyer of the victim's family, says that the U.S. Army threatened him and didn't let him pursue the file.
After the mass killing, the victim's family chose me as the lawyer. At a 2 rounds of trial, the American sergeant Robert Bales was sentenced to death, and it was what the family wanted. But before going to the last trial, Americans threatened me because I was insisting on execution of the murderer. I don't know what happened in the last trial, as the Americans selected one of themselves as the lawyer of the victim's families instead of me.
After 20 years of invasion, the U.S. and its allies hastily abandoned Afghanistan in mid-August last year, leaving Afghans with sad and heartbreaking memories. People in Afghanistan associate the U.S. invasion of their country with destruction, noise raids, and rights violation. They say the U.S. should be held accountable for its war crimes in Afghanistan. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
At the Palace of Versailles, famed as the seat of absolute autocracy and anti-democracy, the leaders of the European Union met in order to discuss possibly historic reversals of long-standing policies as a response to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine.
The challenge is to leave the summit with a firm declaration that a peak of new sanctions is reached, that they will be applied, and that everyone is ready to move towards the same decisions, such as freezing assets of both the Russian central bank and private banks, sanctions on those close to Europe, and reducing gas purchases.
Russia is the biggest supplier of fossil fuels to the European Union, and the meeting will discuss how to reduce as much as two-thirds of its natural gas needs from Russia within a year. That is expected to be extremely painful for businesses and households, and would force a reversal of green energy policies, which many European politicians have insisted were of apocalyptic importance for many years. One of the key arguments often used to defend the EU is that it is responsible for an era of European peace. But many say the two-day conference may provide the foundations for a new European army. For the first time, the EU has sent lethal weapons, even though the bloc won the Nobel Peace Prize in 2012. More than half of Europe has already sent arms to Ukraine, further escalating the conflict.
There needs to be a form of strategic autonomy, which Macron keeps repeating. And if not independence, then less dependence from both Washington and Moscow. The consequences of this conflict will be felt on Europe, so Europe needs to show unprecedented unity and swiftness.
To fund these changes, the leaders are discussing a potentially massive bond sale similar to the bloc's $2 trillion COVID rescue fund, and which they refused to do during the age of austerity. The latest round of Russia-Ukraine peace talks in Turkey failed to make any progress at all. The fallout from the conflict in the Ukraine is provoking massive shifts in historical developments and with a rapidity that few imagine possible. If the two countries can't make peace soon, the world may look very different very quickly. Ramin Mazahari, Paris.
Nigerians under the umbrella of the Concerned Abuja Indigenes said the Nigerian government's refusal to release the travel documents of Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat is part of the unjustifiable oppression of the Islamic cleric and his wife. The group said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki has been brutalized in Zaria in December 2015, resulting in the murder of his six sons and thousands of his followers. They said the Islamic cleric has remained resolute and law-abiding, so there is need for the court to resolve the issue of his travel documents immediately.
Do we expect him dead before the judgment concluded? This is what we are talking about. If the court should keep on delaying, consigning the release of the traveling document, what do we do while the sickness keep on eating the body?
The Abuja Concerned Indigenes said Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki and his wife Zinat have dangerous levels of lead and cadmium in their blood and needed to be hospitalized. They said delaying the medical trip of Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat is an infringement on their rights.
The Constitution of Nigeria has given every individual a right to express, right of movement, right to medication, right of everything, socially. So if right has been given to every individual citizen of the country, why is Sheikh being deprived?
A Kaduna High Court had freed Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zinat since July 28, 2021. The Islamic cleric and his wife had dragged the Nigerian government to court over its refusal to release their passports to go for medical treatment abroad. Danjuma Abdullahi, Abuja.
Already struggling with the cost of living crisis, ordinary Europeans are now feeling the pinch at the pump, with the conflict in Ukraine pushing up the already high food and fuel prices. As plans to phase out oil imports from Russia are drawn up, the ripple effects of the Ukraine crisis are being felt across the continent.
Here in London, people are feeling the economic cost of the ongoing military conflict in Ukraine at the gas pump. Prices have been rising steadily since the start of the year and have now hit a record high. And what that means is that it's going to have a knock-on effect on the cost of transporting goods and, by extension, on the already rising cost of living.
Russia is the world's second largest exporter of oil. The EU imports 27% of its oil from Russia, the UK 11%, and the US just 8%. Which is why Europe will feel the effect of the bans far more acutely than the U.S. The EU also plans to slash its dependency on Russian gas by two-thirds this year. That's 26% of their supply.
It's hard, bloody hard, but it's possible if we're willing to go further and faster than we've done before.
But to make it possible, experts say the Europeans will have to make difficult compromises.
For the new government and Germany actually now saying, actually, we're going to bring back nuclear. Well, that was one of the key things, that they were going to get rid of nuclear completely, very quickly indeed. Then also coal, getting rid of the coal-burning power stations, and particularly those from maybe the using Polish coal, brown coal, which is incredibly dirty.
But could all this have been prevented? While the U.S. and Europe blame Russia's ongoing military offensive in Ukraine for the soaring energy costs, some experts say it's a crisis that could have been averted.
One of the great things about international affairs is to understand not just what you want to achieve, but what the other side wants to achieve. And where's the middle path? Russia generally would want to have a working relationship to protect its security, to make sure its confidence is there. And you know, instead of necessarily having people who are American allies literally a few hundred miles away from your capital, that's something they're not used to. So really understand their nervousness, now try and work out how to deal with it. But we've left it too late.
The new plans will mean less oil revenues for Russia and a faster transition to cleaner energy. But what it also means is a higher risk of inflation and recession across the continent. Saeed Purza, London.
Iran has launched its futures contracts for the first time in the history of its energy exchange market. The futures contracts were launched for the naphtha and methanol trades. According to experts, futures are some very important instruments for the market balance. If other energy carriers, and especially oil, gas, and petrochemical companies, join Iran's energy exchange on futures platform, Iran's crude oil and gas is capable enough to be turned into a benchmark for pricing in the region.
As Iran has the largest oil and gas reserves in the world, the pricing benchmark for our gas and oil should not be elsewhere. The fact is that we should have our own pricing reference for our natural gas in the region. We hope that with the launch of futures and cooperation of all companies in the field of oil and gas, such a thing will happen.
Futures are some very important instruments for the market balance, while they are also some strong hedging tools. They provide investment opportunities for those who are seeking the amount of profit more than they can earn in the normal market deals.
Futures contracts are financial contracts obligating the buyer to purchase an asset or the seller to sell an asset at a predetermined date and price in the future.
The launch of futures trade markets at Iran's energy exchange will contribute to transparency and the predictability of Iran's economy. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The Islamic Jihad movement held a national conference for women in the Gaza Strip on the occasion of International Women's Day. The conference, titled Woman is the Icon of Resistance, highlighted the role of Palestinian women in fighting the Israeli occupation and their struggle for freedom and justice. Palestinian women in the Gaza Strip paid a heavy toll during Israel's war on coastal enclave last year. According to human rights groups, the Israeli regime killed 60 women and 22 children in 2021.
We are supporting our women. We called the international, we addressed the international human rights to support our women, asking the international committee to protect the women, to protect the children, to stop the occupation forces against the women in Palestine.
Addressing the conference through satellite transmission, Islamic Jihad Secretary General Dr. Ziad Nakhala praised the role of Palestinian women and their struggle against the Israeli regime for more than 7 decades.
Palestinian women will not allow anyone to stop her resistance, consider it to be a red line. Palestinian women share military and political struggle with men. Palestinian women has given a lot for her homeland and abroad.
Conference attendees discussed ways of developing new strategies for women to confront the Israeli regime and its illegal practices, especially against women.
Palestinian women today meeting in Gaza to discuss about the role for women, for Palestinian women, and to discuss issues about how to defend the Palestinian in Palestine.
The annual event also tackled ways of bringing international attention to the plight of Palestinian women.
Palestinian women say that they will continue their struggle against the Israeli regime until the liberation of Al-Quds and all of Palestine. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
United States Secretary of State Antony Blinken wrapped up a visit to the leaders of 6 European nations, plus a visit with the European Union and Israel's foreign minister, with a closed-door meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron. Washington has just announced a ban on Russian fossil fuels, but Blinken has apparently not convinced the European Union to immediately sever energy ties with their primary supplier. Russia announced they would cut its oil supplies to Europe if they introduced energy sanctions, which would have a devastating economic impact, perhaps globally. In what many say is an effort to avoid peace and increase the likelihood of a major war, Blinken recently announced that NATO members can send fighter jets to Ukraine. The U.S. and Europe have already provided significant military aid to Ukraine and imposed sanctions so potentially sweeping that Russian Federation President Vladimir Putin recently said they were, quote, like a war.
France is not directly concerned in this conflict, and yet they've already overdone it. When their foreign minister declared an all-out economic and financial war against Russia, that is an act of war. However, there's no economic coherence here because Europe completely depends on Russia for gas, petrol, and titanium, while the loss of export sales to Russia would be a catastrophe for European agriculture.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky recently announced that he, quote, understood that NATO is not prepared to accept Ukraine, end quote, which appears to be a concession to one of Russia's primary demands to end its military operation. The risk of expanding the conflict is a major concern, and with Washington giving Russia a cold shoulder since their offensive, Macron has served as the West's primary mediator with Moscow. Malheureusement,